a bus that's been blown up, or they've seen, you know, Palestinian children who've been shot, or whatever kind of terrible thing they've seen, and it traumatizes you. It does terrible things to you to see that kind of death and violence. And then the next time any little thing happens, all that trauma is layered on top of it. And so, and it builds up in them, and everything that they write starts to become filtered by the unprocessed suffering that they've seen. And so until the journalists can learn how to clear their bodies and hearts of that trauma, they'll be keeping the cycle of violence going because that's all they see. Do you understand?
Wow.
So Stephen, in his work and others, have done this amazing work for 15, 20, 25 years. They've led yatras, which are peace walks across Israel along the Great Wall that had been built between West Bank and Israel, Palestine and Israel. They brought people together to meet in, as that text said, and respect one another, respect their elders, brought people to volunteer and support one another in harmony. And I was able to be part of a walk that Stephen and his group organized across Jerusalem and around the walls of the old city to the Mount of Olives. And there we met with rabbis and sheikhs and, you know, Christian elders and hundreds of people. And it was like the walks that Gandhi used to do or Thich Nhat Hanh did. And it was so moving, and that's part of what the work he's done. And I was surprised to see how much Dharma interest there was in Israel, actually. One of the events that he arranged for me in Tel Aviv, there was almost 1,000 people that came. So there's a kind of hunger for it. And then I spent time on the West Bank, and I got to meet Sami Awad, who runs the Gandhi Nonviolent Center for Palestinians there. And one of their best things he said is, we got the movie Gandhi translated into Arabic. Because he said it used to have subtitles, but Arabic subtitles don't work terribly well. Linguistically, it's hard to get it. And so we got a grant and we translated, because a lot of the people in the Arabic world think that Gandhi was anti-Muslim, which wasn't true in the separation of Egypt. And so that movie was put out in the last few years all throughout the Arab world, which may be one little piece of what's happening now, when you see all these beautiful movements of revolution there. And I got to meet with the bereaved mothers and the former combatants, and it was like that process that Vinnie led. How many of you have lost children? How many of you have lost colleagues and friends and brothers in this insane battle? And I found, and Stephen will tell you, there were literally hundreds of groups that were doing amazing work. And even though right now it's still polarized and terrible, it will change. It has to. Because the West Bank is tiny. You know, it's probably as big as the Bay Area if you go from San Jose to Santa Rosa or something. It's just that big. There are 500,000 Israelis living there and 3 million Palestinians. And they're spread around. It's like Swiss cheese. There's no military solution. You can't do it. They have to be together. And all these groups, the bereaved mothers, the former combatants, the teenagers, they are beginning to weave a fabric that's never in the news. All you see in the news are people with guns and bombs. But they're beginning to weave the fabric of humanity together. And I brought you one image, and then Stephen can start to talk. But even as you listen, I guess before I show you this image, I'm talking about this, whether it was the teacher meeting in New York or the Israelis and the Palestinians, because part of our Dharma practice, once we quiet the mind and make a relationship with our joys and sorrows, is to be able to see one another with kindly eyes, as the Buddha said, to see the humanity of one another, no matter who we are, to really recognize, is that you in there? And you that we are together. And so this is an image from, there's this huge concrete wall that's been built, security wall, and it looks like the walls around San Quentin. It's terrible, you know, like guard towers. And much of it goes into Palestinian territory, and it's cut down olive groves and things that belong to Palestinians. And on the far side, on the West Bank side, In one place, for example, the children drew this huge picture of an olive grove because the olive grove was lost. And they wrote, our olive grove is not lost to us. And there were all these pictures of olive trees on it. And this is a picture, and it's quite large. You can see the car down in the right-hand bottom corner, so it's like 20 feet tall or something, of a peace dove that was painted on the wall. There's lots of graffiti, beautiful graffiti. And as you see in the peace dove, it's carrying an olive branch, but it also has a, the sight from a rifle, as if someone's going to shoot it, but it's also it's wearing a flak jacket, it's wearing a bulletproof vest. It says, okay, you know, it's all right. You know, I'm still here, and I'm still willing to fly the wall and still willing to go from one side to another. So with that, I introduce my friend Stephen, and I'm glad you can be with us.
So I'm very grateful to Jack for inviting me to share the podium with him tonight. And I'm a couple of weeks in the South Bay area teaching Dharma there. What I want to do this evening is really reflect on more than 15 years of working for peace in the Middle East, but working from the perspective of the Dharma. What kind of contributions has the Dharma made to the peace activities that we do, and how does the Dharma work in a situation on the front line? And in that respect, I would like to invite all of you to consider conflict in your own life, and how the kind of things that we're doing and the way Dharma is applied to the pain of conflict, how it might help you as well, because we're all in the midst of a life in which there is bound to be conflict. The Middle Eastern conflict is called an intractable conflict, and it's a self-sustaining cycle. And it's quite amazing that all the professors and all the rabbis and all the priests and all the imams and all the wise men and all the children and all, nobody can stop it. Like, where, what happened to capture a whole people for 100 years in a situation where everybody agrees there is absolute pain and suffering generation after generation and nobody can stop it? And the Buddha is very, here the Buddha is very wise. The Buddha said that there will be quarrels and fights and sticks and weapons will be used as long as there is underlying tendency to be attached to your views, to be somebody separate from others, full of self, to be full of your emotions and your emotional reactions to the other, to be, I guess, a whole list, tendency to want things and not to want things, to and basically just not to be wise and free and open. And these tendencies are fed by the mind that is busy thinking what I want, what I don't want, and proliferating thoughts inside. So what that message is that conflict is natural as long as we have these underlying tendencies, which are really about being a human being, because which one of us doesn't have these underlying tendencies? And that a little bit takes down the pressure, because we will have conflict in our lives, and we shouldn't in a way blame ourselves and think, well, we mustn't have conflict because we must be somewhere, we're higher than that, or we've been practicing, we've been going to retreats, and then we argue with our children or our family, and how is that possible? Or we even teach Dharma, and how is it possible we come home from teaching a retreat and we argue with somebody?
Never. And,
so it really does, I think, we can a little bit relax around that. Conflict is inevitable in the nature of the mind and the underlying tendencies there, and it's very difficult when a whole people is stuck in that situation. I mean, in the Israel-Palestine frame, there really is no concept of what peace is like. Everyone says shalom, shalom, shalom 100 times a day. It's the most used word in Israel, shalom, but nobody has any idea what that means. And it's the most unpeaceful place in the world. So, and there's been plenty of attempts to solve the problem through dialogue and so on. Peace conferences, Oslo, Madrid, Camp David, Geneva, and so on. And it reminds me of this story of the students who come to the rabbi and say, Rabbi, there's so much conflict in the world. How do we solve, how do you solve the conflict? So the rabbi says, well, there's a ordinary way, and then there's a miraculous way. And so the student said, oh, so the ordinary way is people sitting down opposite each other and trying to solve their problems together through dialogue. And the rabbi said, no, no, that's the miraculous way. So at the same time, it's a test. Conflict is a kind of test for us, a test for our wisdom, a test for our spiritual practice. And even the Buddha, by the way, the Buddha's community, there were plenty of conflicts that were unsolvable. I don't know about plenty, but in the literature, in the suttas, there are examples where the Buddha said, I can't deal with you guys. The monks were arguing with each other about points of discipline, and the Buddha himself couldn't solve the problem. So he said, okay, I'm getting out of here. I can't stand you arguing, monks. I'm going to the forest. So the first question that I want to throw out here to us, and the question that we ask ourselves in our peace work, is do we really want to end conflict? Or actually, is there a deeper investment in maintaining conflict? And you can imagine a situation in your own lives, say at work, where there's a conflict inside the workplace and it goes on and on and on, then there is an investment in that. And the mind creates a conflict consciousness. And the consciousness is in loops and keeps going round, and there's so much investment in conflict that nobody really knows how to get out of it. And there is, in a sense, an interest to maintain it, because that's the world I know. I'm against them, the Republicans against the Democrats. Like, we maintain that somehow status of conflict perpetually because we have an interest somewhere in maintaining it. There is in the Middle East that interest in a way in maintaining. It's easily possible to have peace in the Middle East. It's easily possible if there is the will to do it. They are cousins, as we were talking before. There's cousins intermeshed, as Jack was saying, one with another. We're all together there. I live in the Galilee, and I live in a kind of alternative lifestyle village, and right next to us is Druze and Arab towns and villages and Jewish, and we're all fine together, actually. Nobody knows that, but we're living happily in the Galilee next to each other. There's not a wedding in our village or in their village that we don't go there, they come to us. It's easy to do it if there is the will. But there has to be more than a will. There has to be a hunger for it. There has to be, in a way, a sense of we can't cope with this anymore, this suffering. A real hunger, and then it would happen. And until that happens, it's very hard. We're ready to pay a price for peace. So one of the things that we've been doing is the peace walks, and one of the reasons we do a peace walk is not only to create peace outside, but to empower people who are taking part in the walks to actually feel that peace is possible, and to shift the mind from a conflict consciousness to a peace consciousness. So the walks creating a sense of hope, of steadiness, of I can change something. Because before, and this is relevant to all of us here, before we can really deal with conflict, especially when it's embedded in a group or in a family or in a workplace, we have to build ourselves, in a sense, to be peacemakers, to be out of the loop, and to feel empowered. We can change things. So I want to talk about what the peace walks feel like. I was going to show one or two pictures, but it's not kind of relevant to the room here. But we walk in silence, in a long line, one after another, Palestinians and Israelis, Jews and Arabs. And we walk slowly and mindfully in silence. And we walk, we used to walk, we don't do it so much anymore, but we did for years. There is a steadiness that begins to grow, and a sense of, I'm walking on this earth with my brothers. It's non-verbal, it grows on the inside, a sense of being, I am together with, we are no different from each other. It's very powerful, the peace walks, because we do it, we walk slowly and mindfully, and it's powerful as an image. We've been on the television quite a few times, because when people see us walking through the towns and through Jerusalem and through Tel Aviv, also through the countryside, small villages, people stop and look at us. There's a real strong message in there. And sometimes we've had people on the side watching us and crying, especially in a way older people that see that we're doing something, expressing something with our bodies, with our being, that cannot be expressed by words. We express peacefulness. And here is an important message of the Dharma for all of us in relation to conflict. It is not, you can solve or help to solve conflicts not necessarily on the level of story. What is my story? What is your story? But on the level of walking your talk, on the level of being, on the level of peacefulness. If you can be peaceful, that gives a powerful message to the other, and of course to yourself. One of the slogans we use in the peace walks is, there is no way to peace, peace is the way. So we don't want to sort of run after peace over there, but we want to be peaceful here, right now, embodying it, and that makes the change, or that helps to make the change in us and in others. And it's a radical shift. It is nothing about who is right and who is wrong. It's a sense of shifting in the mind. There's a beautiful Buddhist text about this, that the Buddha was asked, how do you solve problems if there's real conflict and differences in views and anger and so on? And the Buddha said, well, if there is no strong views and no strong emotions of anger and rage and so on, it's easy. If there is strong views but no strong emotions, it's difficult, but it's tiring, but it's possible to talk to the person. If there is strong emotions but no strong views, difficult, but it is possible to talk to the person. But if there is both strong views and strong emotions, which is situation I think in Israel-Palestine, then you can't use the language, but never underestimate the power of equanimity. That's the bottom line there. Never underestimate the power of equanimity. And sometimes when you're in the middle of a conflict, you can just be equanimous and steady, and something changes in the environment. I remember I used to teach a class of in the Dharma class of the elderly of the kibbutzim in the north, and they were all above 70 years old, this class. And one woman, after a while, she came back to me and she said, you know what, when all my family are fighting and screaming and shouting at each other, and the children running about and the adults arguing about politics, I take my chair, I sit right in the middle of the room, I sit quietly like this, and I breathe, And slowly, slowly, everybody quietens down. So one of the questions that we need to ask ourselves in relation to conflict, and I invite all of you to remember conflicts you've had or that you have now, and consider how your equanimity, some steadiness, some embodiment of peace, some inner quiet can help where the argument doesn't, where the stories, who's right, who's not right, will go nowhere. And just reflect on that. And another issue that we practice in the peace walks is a sense of less investing in ourselves, in being a Palestinian, a Jew, a Israeli, a tall or short or young or old. A sense that in the line, as we walk, we are all the same. There's no difference. And it's, in a way, a relief. People who come to the walk say, oh, I'm so relieved. I don't have to hold this pressure of being an Israeli and them and us. It's holding. It takes a lot of energy to hold that us and them place. It's a big relief to kind of, oh, I can just be with others without the boundaries. And the boundaries include protection. I need to protect myself against the other. The boundaries are fundamental. The protection is part of the building of the boundary, and in fact part of the building of a self. It's about protection. And so when we can let go a little bit of our fears, we let go of the boundaries. And then we can invite the other, whoever they are, to come in. I've got a story. One of the old-timers in the peace walks is a Bedouin sheikh, a leader of a Bedouin tribe called Abu Amin. And once we were doing a walk in the northern town of Akko, by the sea. And we went to the local rabbi of the town and said, we want to do this walk. You're welcome to have your Jewish students come and join us if you want, but we'd like your blessing. And he said, fine, and he gave us his blessing and so on. And then he asked Abu Amin, the rabbi, and there's a beautiful little dialogue. The rabbi asked Abu Amin, this Bedouin sheikh with the headdress and so on, how do you make peace, actually? What do you do personally to make peace? And Abu Amin said, when I go through a Jewish town or village, at the head of the line of peace walkers, and we walk slowly through, if someone shouts at me, go home, Arab, I absorb that violence into me and smile and let it go. And when I absorb other people's violence, that stops the chain. That's pure Dharma, coming from Bedouin Sheikh. It's his Dharma, but that's the wisdom, a real deep wisdom, a truth that is in a way beyond any ownership, beyond any group. It's a fundamental truth. And when we reduce the sense of self and the sense of boundary, we can begin to put ourselves in other people's shoes. And Shantideva, a great Buddhist teacher, said, putting yourself in the other's shoes is sacred. It's a sacred act. There's something holy about it. It's not superficial. It's something deep. If we can put ourselves in the other's shoes, we're reducing our sense of protection, our boundaries, our limited self, and we're expanding ourselves to include the other. And that act of putting ourselves in the other's shoes is a powerful act, and it needs effort sometimes. Have to go out and do that. And it needs, in a way, our whole life of mindfulness, of spiritual practice. In a way, we bring to a conflict our whole previous life. It's not something that we can easily learn from day to tomorrow. In the middle of a conflict, actually, it's sometimes very difficult to see where our head and tail is. We're in the middle of a conflict, it's stormy, it takes us over. So we need, in a way, practice when we're not in conflict to apply to when we are in conflict. And in a way, it demands our whole spiritual life and all the meditations we can possibly do. That's the moment when we need it. And that empathy and that reducing self allows also some deeper questions, like maybe underneath, subconsciously, I expect someone else to change more than I expect myself to change. Maybe I want them to do the change and I'm not ready to change myself. One of the most, we found in another, we did another kind of activity in which we found the most powerful way of building empathy and putting ourselves in the other's shoes and creating peace is based on the first noble truth of the Buddha, which is, if suffering and pain is known, is a brother rather than an enemy, is known, that liberates us. There's a liberation inside the familiarity, the intimacy with pain and suffering. And so we use this in workshops. We brought Israelis, each time 15 Israelis, to the Palestinian territories, the city of Nablus in the West Bank, and we met with 15 Palestinians, and we would go to them. In other words, we allow them to host us, which is a very important symbolic act, that the Palestinians wouldn't have to keep running to the dominant power or the dominant force in the Israelis and sort of come to us. We came to them. And we did this for about 7 years. Nearly every month or every couple of months, we brought another group to Annapolis. We worked for 48 hours. We decided we needed to do something intensive, work 48 hours, and we slept in Palestinian houses there. The first day of the 2 days was just about feeling safe with each other. It was just about friendliness and warmth and sharing small stories and so on, having cups of tea together, and so on. Then on the second day, the heart of the workshop happened, which was in dyads, with four eyes, taking as much time as we need, sometimes an hour and a half, sharing each other's pain. And one of the parties, the Palestinian or the Israeli, would begin to tell the pain of his life or her life. And the second person would just be deep listening, occasionally asking questions or helping, but not responding with their story. And then it would go to the second person, who would tell their pain, how their daily life is the suffering that this conflict creates, or any other suffering that comes up for them. And the second person was the listener. And we gave it real space, and then we came back together again and sort of wrapped ourselves together as a whole group and sort of held it, and from there reflected on what happened. And it really made this act of sharing pain made an amazing difference. Something irreversible happened then, and people who went through this workshop again and again and again told us that something irreversible happened. There was a change that after that we couldn't go back to the old story of conflict and labeling. And we had soldiers coming in our group, not in uniform, but there were soldiers that were coming in the group, and we had Palestinian street fighters coming into the group and sharing. And people again said what Jack said before, I never realized that Israelis could be human beings. Oh, I never realized that Palestinians suffered so much from us. One time there was, I remember, two Palestinians, so Hamas, basically street fighters, and they came to the workshop, and they started the evening, or in the day, standing on the side and cursing. And they're cursing the Palestinians, saying, how can you talk to Israelis? And they were cursing the Israelis, saying, how can you come here? You're killers, you're soldiers, you're killing us. And they just stood at the side of the room cursing. And then slowly, during the day, we kept inviting them in. They refused, and they quietened down a bit and just threw comments now and then. We went through our process, and the next day they came back, and we were very surprised. And there they were. And we asked them, please, you don't have to be part of this, but just tell us your story. Mm-hmm. And they came and they told, of course, this terrible story about stories, that how each family had been affected, how their sister had been killed in one case, and a small brother had been killed in the street in another case, shot, and their family, their parents had been taken off to prison, and all kinds of things, terrible stories. And they told their story, and we were listening, we held them. In our attention, in our deep listening, and something really changed. And one of the Israeli participants, who was a very motherly woman of 55, and she sort of went to them and hugged them and said, you're like my children. You are like my sons. I love you like my sons. 8 years later, these two young guys are still telephoning the same woman who lives in a kibbutz in Israel and saying, are you still with us? We're with you. We're with you. Are you our mother? You're still our mother. You are our mother. You're our mother forever. I mean, it was very powerful, this work that we did. So, if you can manage to allow some of that pain to emerge in any situation of conflict, it's the truth emerges, and the truth heals. And the allowing the pain to come up, instead of the denying of the pain and closing it down and shutting it down and just projecting onto the other, is allowing of the pain to be shared mutually is one of the most powerful ways of solving conflict and getting into the other's shoes, being in empathy, being in harmony. It shifts everything. So one other aspect that I want to mention, another kind of tool that we used, is basically simple friendliness and compassion. It is the oil that makes the gears of work. These weekends, we just spread friendliness. One of the pictures that I wanted to show you, but you can imagine it, is Abu Amin, the Bedouin sheikh, in real intimacy with two Israeli soldiers, and they're laughing together and they're touching each other. And he was a great, he spread friendliness. We all spread friendliness as we walked through the towns and the villages. If someone shouted at us, and people often did, we just beamed friendliness. If people, we never got actual physical violence against the walkers, but lots of verbal violence. We just beamed friendliness. But if also to the dogs passing by and the birds flying over, the policemen that walk with us sometimes to, on the flanks or in front of, give them friendliness, offer them tea. The people, the right wing, the left wing, just keep beaming friendliness. And it's a healing process, and it's something that, again, we can practice in our own life. Just beaming friendliness. compassion, friendliness, and with it is a sort of big picture, because friendliness is something beyond the self. It's something that collects all of us together, and we can feel in conflict. If we're in conflict with somebody, or in a situation of conflict, not only we can express friendliness, but a little bit a sense that we are caught in something that is beyond our control. There is nothing to do here except compassion. There is something here that's rolling that we can't actually solve. And so compassion is always there, friendliness is always there to wrap the parties together and hold the parties together in friendliness. And here is our compassionate heart can sometimes heal where other things cannot. It's a big story. We can hold the Israelis and the Palestinians in compassion. It's too big for people to solve right now, but compassion is always there. So the final comment, lots of people ask us, does it work? Has it made peace? Well, they're still fighting, so what did you do actually? All your Buddhist peace work, you know, why didn't you stop the... And the Buddha himself, by the way, didn't manage to stop, although he did stop this one with the Vijayans, but he didn't stop other fights, battles at the time. And if the Buddha himself can't do it sometimes, then don't feel too bad that we can't do it either. But the truth is that we were doing a non-political work. We were not there to do politics. But what we were doing is trying to create peacemakers. We were trying to empower people to be, each one in their own life, a peacemaker, and to empower, to educate, to train. So a teacher, a Palestinian teacher, can go back to school after going to one of our workshops and know what to say to the children. Yes, the Israelis are not all soldiers. Yes, there are people there that really want peace. And the Israeli can go back to his Israeli teacher, workers, a soldier can go back to his unit and say, yeah, Palestinians suffering, they're human beings, they want peace like everybody. We've just been projecting all these stories on them. And it keeps alive a message. And maybe this message that we're keeping alive, a kind of a flame that we're keeping alive, the picture of the dove, we're just holding that. And at the right time, I trust and I have faith, when the karma makes it possible, then our bit will be there. And a small story to illustrate this, that you never quite know where the results will pop up. There was a very difficult crisis when the government had to eject Jewish settlers from Gaza. And this happened some years ago, I forget when, but all the Jewish settlers in Gaza were taken out of Gaza, and they were building for months a violent reaction. In the newspapers they were storing weapons, but it was the Israeli army and the police had to go there and get people out of their homes. And one of our Dharma practitioners, one of the people, old time Buddhist practitioner from our Dharma community, actually had access to the soldiers and the officers and the police there for some reason. He served with them in the army, and he managed to show how ways of non-violence could work where violence didn't work. And he actually helped to train the officers and the soldiers to do the work they had to do with some more compassion and non-violence. And it was extraordinary. Nobody could understand. It happened without any violence whatsoever. And the newspapers afterwards were saying, how is it possible? We were all prepared, the whole country was prepared for a huge violence, and it all went really peacefully. And so I think that it does work, but not in the way that necessarily we, in the linear way that we kind of look and see, have expectations. So finally, we've got a new program now called the Ceasefire Within, and the Ceasefire in the Heart, and we're now doing groups and in Israel of really trying to help people look at the way they build views and the conflict consciousness. And so we're doing that work, and I have also a dream. I would love to lead a peace walk through Central Park to bring out from the synagogues the Jews and from the communities the Muslims, and just keep walking slowly and silently around Central Park until the crazy suffering pain of the Middle East stops.
Just a couple more words and we'll end. First, a lot of gratitude to Stephen. And I want to say that all the money that you put in the basket tonight and all the money that you gave as you came in, and all of it is going to be used for both his work and other of these groups that Stephen has been a part of. So please be generous in that way tonight. But these last few words, this is from Thomas Merton, and it's really echoing what Stephen said. Oh, and I need to say, he also has a clinic right on the line between the Israel and Palestine, a naturopathic kind of clinic, and he's been helping the Arab and Palestinian community on the other side reclaim their indigenous herbal medicine, which has gotten lost. So they're coming over to the Israeli side to work with Stephen as a doctor and learn, again, be re-empowered to use all the kinds of indigenous medicine that was part of their tradition. But this from Thomas Merton. He writes, as a mystic and a sage, he says, "Do not depend on the hope of results. You may have to face the fact that your work will be apparently worthless and achieve no result at all, if not perhaps bring about its opposite. As you get used to this, you start more and more to concentrate not on the results, but on the value, the rightness, and the truth of the work itself." And these were his words to activists. And there's some way in which, you know, it's hundreds and thousands of people that Stephen's trained and that have done these walks for hours or days across all the parts of Israel and parts of Palestine, and, you know, the ceasefire within very large community of people, that it's planting seeds. And those seeds, the way things work in the world, if you plant good seeds, eventually, however long it takes, eventually they bear fruit and they become what grows. And then I have this thing that I sometimes read from the Associated Press last year after the earthquake in Haiti. The American Red Cross got all these donations for the people in Haiti, but nothing stood out like the coins and crumpled dollar bills that spilled from one envelope. A gift, $14.64, came from the pockets of homeless people at downtown Baltimore shelter with the note, "We are worried about our brothers and sisters in Haiti." Mm-hmm. There's something that you said about sharing our pain and with it the compassion and the connection and the love of humanity that comes when we're real with one another. So whether we sit in our own meditation and deal with our joys and sorrows and our full measure of humanity, and that prepares us in some way to be able to look in another's eyes, as Stephen said, in those groups, and, you know, just to sit and listen to one another. It's what changes the world. Nothing, I mean, all the outer things are important and need to be done, but more than anything, it's not going to be, you know, biotechnology and computers and internet and all those things. They can be used for peace or war, either way. It's also going to have to be a change of human heart and human consciousness. And I respect so much the work that Stephen's done and that so many of you do. And thank you for it. So let's just sit for a moment.